Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Jordana Yu. In her follow-up to the best-selling Loving Frank, Nancy Horan recounts the improbable love affair between Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson and his American wife, Fanny Osborne. In The Wide and Starry Sky, Horan invites us to explore the Stevensons' unusual relationship and the ways they change the literary and artistic landscape around them. It is a great pleasure to welcome Nancy Horan to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm happy to be here.
I loved reading this book because it has gotten me now on a Robert Louis Stevenson kick. I, of course, read the Child's Garden of Verses as a child and at a very young age became enamored with the Land of Counterpane. So mm-hmm. I've been rediscovering all of that. What led you to Stevenson?
Well, I had read Stevenson in the same way you had, probably. I mean, Treasure Island. I was an English major in college, so I got my exposure in terms of Treasure Island and The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and the poetry. But it was discovering that he had been living in Monterey, California, that took me by surprise. And I was visiting that area, and I learned that he had lived there for a while. And I just wondered, what was this young Scottish man doing there? And it turned out he had made this grueling journey from England to California, hoping to win the hand of a woman he'd fallen in love with in France, Fanny Osborne, who was a Californian, married with children, still married when he went seeking her hand.
She is 10 years older than he is.
10 years, yes.
And it takes him quite a while to be able to get to California to sort of wait it out, if you will.
Right, exactly.
His parents were not thrilled with this, and it took some time.
It did take time, and the journey nearly killed him because he had never had great health. He had poor lungs. It was 19th century, no antibiotics, and not a clear diagnosis of what he had. Later, it was thought he had tuberculosis, but it could have been something else. That's been questioned. So in any case, he had had periods in his life when he had been confined to bed, certainly as a child and as a young man. And so in coming to America, his friends and his family were naturally concerned about him because his health was not great. He was also nearly penniless, and yet he had fallen in love with this woman, and he was absolutely determined to become a great writer and to win her hand. Those were his two goals. So my exposure was limited, but before I knew him and as I came to know him, I discovered he was a far more varied, complex writer than I had thought him to be.
It's interesting because, as I mentioned, The Land of Counterpane, when I was sick and lay abed, I had two pillows at my head and all my toys beside me lay to keep me happy all the day. Sickness and illness really played a great part, not only in his life, but in his writing. It had an impact.
It did. It certainly did. And when you say that verse, I think of the poignancy of that verse. Mm. Because as a child, listening to your parent read that verse, you think, oh, I know what it feels like to be sick. But as an adult, if you know that he was sickly much of his life, then you have compassion for him.
I want to get to the story of the two of them in a moment, but it is important to note that when you're reading this novel, there is so much travel and there are so many different places that they are going. All of this is being done pretty much because of his illness. There is a search for a place where he will be well.
Absolutely. Their married life really was a quest for the right climate in which he might improve his health and be able to actually thrive, because he did have periods of health off and on. And when he met Fanny Osborne, he was relatively well. It seems to me, as a modern person, that it was all about good air in the 19th century. It was this great pursuit of good air. And they certainly tried so many different places seeking good health for him. Some climates where they were in Davos, Switzerland, very cold, high in the Alps. Another doctor might recommend 15 miles as the crow flies from the ocean, you know, above a fog line. And so they went many places. They spent their honeymoon on top of Mount St. Helena in Napa County in California, camping in an abandoned silver mining shack. And it was the beginning of their marriage, and it was so emblematic of what the rest of their marriage would be like, which would be trying to make a home in so many different kinds of circumstances. And Fanny was a pro at that.
The Adirondacks was another location, but also cold. And they found some solace on the sea.
Well, that's where they found his lungs improved, is when he was breathing sea air. And that led to a two-year cruise of the South Seas, three different legs of that journey, and both of them documenting, both Fanny and Lewis documenting that experience. She wrote The Cruise of the Janet Nicol, which was the third leg of their journey before they settled in Samoa, which is where he ended up thriving, believe it or not.
On the face of it, it doesn't seem as though the two of them have that much in common, but they certainly have the fact that they're both free spirits.
I think so. They found common ground. Well, she was interested in literature. You start by looking at their differences. Here was this American woman. She was not college educated. She was older than he. He came from an upper class family of lighthouse builders, sophisticated family, an American, a Scot. There were many differences between them, but they both shared bohemian tastes. She had been part of a bohemian crowd in California with her first husband. And with Lewis, she was attracted to his literary circle, and you know, she liked that life, and so did he. And so both of them were unconventional in that sense.
Lewis, of course, is what most people called Robert Louis Stevenson. And when he first meets her, he falls in love. It's another meeting, right? It takes her a while.
It took her a while because, first of all, you have to understand that she was grieving. When they met at the Hotel Chevillon in Grasse-sur-Loing, and she was there with her children, recuperating from a staggering loss that had occurred while she was in Paris. And he was there to enjoy a holiday with his bohemian friends. And so they were in a very festive mood. By the time he arrived, Fanny had been there a few weeks. She was processing her grief. And then she's descended upon by all these bohemian friends who are there to party. Slowly, she becomes friendly with these people. And I think Stevenson was very kindly to her, is my guess. And he was probably quite comforting to her. And he also lightened the whole scene. Nevertheless, he was immature through her eyes. I mean, she was very puzzled. She wrote about it in letters to friends that he had certain habits which were bizarre. If he was saddened by some incident, he would throw himself on the ground weeping. And if he was delighted and started laughing, he couldn't stop laughing sometimes. His friends knew what to do, but she couldn't believe her eyes, but they would bend back his hand until he was screaming in pain, and then he could stop laughing. And she wrote to a friend and said, "I don't know whether to hand him a handkerchief or look out the window." I mean, she was embarrassed. So it took her a while to adapt to him.
And when they finally get together, he is still a relatively unknown travel writer.
He was relatively unknown. So think about what she did, what she risked to marry him. He had no reputation, he had no money, and he was ill. He was so set back by his journey to America that when she finally married him a year later, he was still very weak. And so when they took their honeymoon, they had no money. So they went to, you know, as I said, the abandoned mining shack. It was in an effort to heal him. It was her nursing and her care for him began from the time he arrived until the end of their marriage.
And yet what is fascinating, as you write about in the novel, is how they shape each other's artistic lives.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It is.
She was an influence in a variety of ways. He called her my critic on the hearth. And he had a system where he would write, and then at the end of the day or at the end of the week, he would read aloud to whoever was present, but certainly to Fanny. He trusted her judgment. At the same time, he didn't follow it all the time, but he liked to have her feedback. And she was involved in his decision to rewrite The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is that it came from a dream. Stevenson had a powerful dream one night, and he was yelling. And his wife went to wake him up, and he said, quick, bring me the paper. And he proceeded to write the first draft of The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in 3 days, 30,000 words. And when he finished it, he read it aloud, as was the practice. And Fanny didn't love it. And she encouraged him to make it more of a universal allegory for any reader to respond to and to be chilled by the idea that within herself or himself, each reader might carry the seeds of both good and evil. I mean, it should resonate with every reader. And so he burned the manuscript and started over, and for the next 3 days wrote another 30,000 words. So she had some influence in the direction of that particular story. On the other hand, you know, she objected to a number of things he did and encouraged him to go into playwriting, which was a bad direction for him. So her influence was not always the most positive thing. He encouraged her writing to a point, and she did manage to get a couple of things published, but it was thought that she got published because she was the wife of Robert Louis Stevenson, or so she thought. In any case, she perceived it that way. So Fanny's literary career, she'd been interested in writing before she met Stevenson. She hadn't published anything, but it took second place to her responsibility for keeping Stevenson alive. And so her greatest contribution really was keeping Robert Louis Stevenson alive. We probably wouldn't have The Master of Ballantrae, Kidnapped, you know, many of his novels and short stories and essays. And he was so prolific in what he did. And he tried so many genres. He was fearless in that way.
He was even a composer.
Of music, yes.
I have to say that in reading the novel, I was pleasantly surprised at what a nice guy he seems to be. There's a gentleness. He's humorous. He certainly is very supportive emotionally to Fanny during her divorce. In those 19th century authors, you don't often see or read about someone who is genuinely a pretty nice guy.
Nice guy. Believed in kindness above all. He took issue with some of the realism that existed at the time. He was considered by some people to be strictly a romantic, you know, holdout. But he really believed that the very dark, pessimistic realism that some stories by Zola, for example, exhibited was a negative force and not good for the reader, in a sense. He said that he preferred the realism of the poets, and that was to find where joy resides and give it a voice beyond singing. So you have a man here who, I think, had to reinvent himself as a positive person every day, particularly when he was bedridden. His arm was bound in a sling so that he wouldn't be tempted to write, for example, for fear of disturbing his lungs and creating another hemorrhage. This is a guy who probably had a general psychological makeup that was positive, but he was also a man who really had to find a way of making himself happy. And I think that writing allowed him to do that, allowed him to transcend the circumstances and the limitations of his body.
Nancy Horan is the author of the new novel Under the Wide and Starry Sky. It is published by Ballantine Books. One of the things that is hard to comprehend fully is that he died at the age of 44, and he accomplished so much. What was success like for him, and what was it like for the relationship?
Well, I think he often talked about writing in terms of supporting a family. And when he married Fanny, he took on the responsibility. I mean, he agreed, in a sense, to a pact. He agreed that he would support the family. So he went at his writing furiously, almost as a badge of his own manhood, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's something I've come to understand because a reader pointed this out to me. She said, well, given his limitations, it must have allowed him to get in touch with his own manhood, that he was supporting his family through his work. You know, I think that's absolutely true. I think that's a wonderful insight on her part. Success really hit not until The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Treasure Island preceded that, and it was widely read. But in America, the book, Jekyll and Hyde, was pirated, and plays were being produced by the time he came to America again in 1888-89, just before they went on their South Seas voyage. So slowly what happened is, he became self-sufficient, as he had hoped to be. He didn't want to be dependent on an allowance that his father had given him in his early years. He freed himself of that. He was able to underwrite a great sea voyage and take a luxury yacht for 6 months from San Francisco through the South Seas and to Hawaii. He was able to build a grand home in Samoa. The reality was, however, that they spent most of their money. So money was always a concern. But I think he probably enjoyed being a celebrity to a degree. I think he couldn't help but enjoy that. But he was really a man of the people, on the other hand. He hated the class system. He celebrated common people.
You speak about The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and he was starting to get a reputation as a children's author. Here comes this book, and it's so dark.
Right. So dark. And that, I think, is a perfect argument against this image of him that we've really developed in the 20th century. I think people who read Stevenson actually read him and read his South Seas stories, which are very realistic, saw that he was much more than only a writer of boys' adventure stories. And hopefully what comes out of this book that I've written is that people will be interested in checking out Stevenson, finding out more about him, and trying some of the things that he's read that are not as widely known.
Because he was prolific.
He was tremendously prolific, absolutely. And as his health improved in the South Seas, he became more politically active. I mean, which was an inclination he'd had. He was always for the underdog, but he hadn't been able to act upon very much because of his illnesses. And he certainly became active in opposing colonization in Samoa and wrote many letters to the Times of London protesting certain political activities on the part of the British government. And he became engaged as a citizen of a place.
I read this novel over the course of a few days and then started to reread Stevenson. and was struck by exactly what you were talking about. I'm curious as to, for you, because you spent 5-6 years working on this and researching and spending time with these two people. So what do you get out of then rereading Stevenson and even Fanny's work?
Well, in terms of Fanny's work, to start with, I read The Cruise of the Janet Nicol. And it gave me insights into what her life was like during that time. And basically her courage. She would sleep on deck when their cabin was too hot or so uncomfortable. She would sleep up top with the other sailors. She had rats running over her face. You know, this is an example of what I mean by, could I do that? I don't know if I could or not. So it was fascinating to just take a look at her life. And that book in particular reveals what women's lives were like for both Native women and for missionaries at that time. You get an insight. They were seeing stuff that many Europeans simply hadn't seen, except for missionaries from America and Europe. It's marvelous to look at those stories and see what an adventurer she was. Well, he was too. He was too. And he was intent on writing a big book about the South Seas. What he eventually produced was in the South Seas, you know, there's numerous essays about the politics, the things they saw, the evidence, the negative evidence of the impact of Western culture on Native populations and their cultures. So it's insightful when you read his essays, I think, and you see what a political thinker he was. We don't give him credit for that. We think of him as writing about pirates only.
Under the Wide and Starry Sky is the first line of a requiem.
It is. It is.
How did you decide on that for the title?
First of all, the poem, Requiem, is engraved on his tomb. And I think that it was a very meaningful poem to him. He began writing that when he was on the train going across America. He didn't finish it for a couple of years. He did survive that very difficult trip. But it's just a beautiful poem. And he often wrote about starry skies. When Fanny left him after they'd been together in Europe and she went back ostensibly to divorce her husband, he went on a long hike through the Cevennes, and he wrote a book about it, a long travel book about it, about his journey, Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes. A great book to read if you want to become acquainted with Robert Louis Stevenson, the travel writer. And in that book, he envisioned what it would be like to be next to the person he loved, lying on his back, you know, with his head protruding from a tent and looking at the starry sky. To him, not speaking, the person he would be with, and he was thinking of Fanny the whole time, that person would not have to speak because they would so well understand each other. But that image of lying there looking at the sky, the night sky, was to him an image of pure happiness. So you read a lot in Stevenson about starry skies. I mean, he was a hiker. He was an outdoors person. He loved being right on the deck with the sailors when they were traveling in the South Seas. There are photographs of him having the time of his life.
The novel is Under the Wide and Starry Sky. It is published by Ballantine Books. Nancy Horan, thank you very much for spending time with us. A delight to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the program. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. This show was recorded at Argo Studios in New York. Our thanks to their crew. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.